From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 339, IPv6 Moves Forward, with guest Tom Hollingsworth. Recorded Monday, September 16th, 2013. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Tom Hollingsworth, and Tom is a community organizer with Gestalt IT and Tech Field Day, focused on the interactions between social media influencers and vendors. Tom has 10 years of experience with networking and IT for kindergarten to grade 12 schools, and he's a blogger at networkingnerd.net and an avid tweeter as @networkingnerd. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Always a pleasure to talk to a good networking guy. And apparently we're associated through Stephen
Foskett. Yes.
Foskett, yes.
I was a delegate at his Tech Field Day series for the last couple of years. And then this year he asked me if I wanted to come on board and kind of shadow him to do some of his work with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an opportunity I just couldn't turn down. So I stepped out of a technical role from the implementation perspective and moved more into more of an architecture role where I got to see new technologies as they're being discussed and designed and kind of help people along to understand those.
And yeah, we keep thinking that networking is the easy part of the equation. You just get the cables and you plug them in. But it seems like it's a really interesting time to be in networking.
Yes. Yes, it is. Networking has largely been pretty well static for the last, I would say, maybe 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Things are just getting faster, and then something happened with data centers where we started needing massive amounts of data moved back and forth in different directions, and it was hard to keep up. So some geniuses out in California started coming up with the idea of adding programmability and automation and things, and we wrapped that around a term called software-defined networking.
Right.
And that's really kind of it's driving a lot of development in the IT industry today.
When I like this concept of SDN just being virtualization for networking, the same way we virtualized our servers, and now, and this is what I talked with Stephen about, was virtualizing storage too.
Mm-hmm. And the idea is really sound because we have an army of people out there who are very good at programming in a multitude of different languages.
Mm-hmm.
All we need to do is give them an interface into our subsystems, whether they be storage or networking or servers, and allow them to come up with some really ingenious ways to drive more performance and repeatability out of the network. Because you've got a group of people inside of networking who are really pushing the idea behind automation, for instance, and saying, why do we pay people to do a job that a script or a robot could do just as effectively? Why don't we reemploy those people into grander network architect roles where they understand the interactions between a SAN and a 40 gig uplink switch?
Sure.
And a server cluster?
Well, and I buy the idea that software-defined networking makes it really simple for me to dynamically configure things. You know, then it'd be part of, and make it part of a package that can be rolled out in other places and so forth, and easy to change and reconfigure and redeploy. But how do you get more speed out of that?
So one of the ways that you get speed out of it is not necessarily by making the underlay network faster, and the underlay is a term that we're starting to use to describe the actual networking hardware.
The physical stuff.
The physical stuff, yes. But speed of provisioning. So one of the things that VMware talked about at VMworld this year was the disconnect when you hand off a project to your underlay network team where it could take 2, 3, 4 weeks to have the networking resources provisioned.
Right.
To support your project. And what they're wanting to do is close that gap significantly through their technologies, and then other vendors like Cisco and Juniper are using similar technologies to do very similar things from a different perspective.
So this automation to deployment is the big win on SDN.
Yes. Yeah. That's a lot of the people who are starting to get behind the movement are seeing that, you know, server guys have things like Puppet and Chef, where they can turn up a server from bare metal to functional in a matter of minutes.
Yes.
And we're starting to integrate tools like that into our networking constructs as well, so that we don't have to send some poor junior admin out into the middle of a wiring closet somewhere with a console cable and a laptop and a list of all the commands he needs to type in to bring it online for us.
My worry with abstractions like this is that when there's a physical problem, it's that much harder to diagnose.
Yes, that is becoming a significant pain point for people now. It's hard enough to do network monitoring as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to keep track of so many different variables, latency and throughput and hop-by-hop analysis to find out where the problems are. And especially with VMware's approach, which uses something called a V-wire, a virtual wire, which behaves very similarly to what networking people call a tunnel, like a VPN tunnel, something like that.
What
happens when there's a dropout in the middle of that tunnel in the underlay, but you can't see it because your monitoring system has no visibility beyond the tunnel?
Right.
You know, we actually have to redouble our efforts to ensure that the underlay works properly and that we keep track of it. I like to think of it more like the electrical grid that people are, you know, using their homes and things like that. When you plug a toaster into the electrical grid, you have no visibility into the power plants and the transmission lines and things like that, but the electric company does, and it's their responsibility to ensure that the service is delivered to your power outlet.
Yeah, and that's an interesting part of this whole equation, is that this stuff becomes automatic and we just don't need to think about it anymore.
Right
up until it's a problem, or right up until you saturate it. You know, I used to think gigabit Ethernet was a lot, but I've been in networking long enough to remember what it's like when you do saturate a network again, because Ethernet isn't pretty when things get really, really fast. Its method of decay is pretty hard, and the instrumenting that in a rational way, in a way that doesn't actually make the problem worse, has always been really tough.
Yes, and we've come up with all sorts of different kinds of tricks to do that. Quality of service is probably one of the most well-known. We're going to do things like introduce priority queues and weighted queuing so that we can kick out packets that don't need to be in there in favor of ones that need to get there faster. And as we keep increasing link speeds to 10, 40, 100 gigabits, it becomes more apparent when those links get saturated because there's no upward mobility.
Yeah.
I mean, they're working on the terabit Ethernet standard right now, but who knows when that's going to be done. And that's one of the things that SDN gives us the capability of seeing at a higher level, is to create policies that say these traffic flows need to go through this device and they need to use these links in the event of a saturation. And one of my biggest concerns is that I want the applications that are running on top of these software-defined networks to be able to react to traffic conditions, almost like a traffic control GPS that you might have in your car.
Right.
So if the network says, okay, these two links that are going from New York to London are completely saturated with traffic due to some kind of vMotion event or a live backup, I need you to fail over and use the link that goes through Tokyo, which is slower, but it will, your packets will actually arrive faster.
Yes. Well, and I mean, wasn't this what TCP/IP was all about in the first place, this sense of dynamic routing? Of course, it was routing around failure, not so much routing around performance, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, you're right. And it was pretty resilient when you look at it. You know, the ability to have layer three constructs that prevent any kind of outage from being an Achilles heel was great until someone decided that in order for layer two data center mobility to work properly, we need to blow away all those IP addresses. Think about what happened the last time you vMotioned a server. Everything worked because the IP address of that server didn't change.
Right.
And now we're running into issues where that doesn't scale very well, or it doesn't scale across geographic locations.
NAT is coming back to haunt us again.
Yes, it is.
I love it.
Yeah. And so that's one of the reasons why VMware came up with the NSX product line, which uses tunnels and V-wires and things like that, is because it allows them to kind of do a zigzag away from the necessary layer two data center interconnect pieces. Now with V-wires, we can do some interesting things because the V-wire, the tunnel it uses is essentially VXLAN, which is, you know, it's a multi-tenancy construct that allows us to extend past the 4096 VLAN limit that we were running into inside of a data center, especially in environments where you have customers that have multiple VLANs assigned to them, and the data center administrators were looking around going, you know, if we get any more people that sign up for our service, we're going to run out of numbers.
Well, I also think that VLANing has fundamentally changed when you get into SDN in the first place. I would think we use VLANs even more. You start thinking about the connections between these virtual instances as part of the overall application strategy, so that you'd almost want a VLAN configuration per app.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing is that the consumption of VLANs to segment traffic or to force traffic to take specific paths is, you know, it's going up. It's like when cell phones first came out, and all of a sudden we realized we don't have enough telephone numbers for these, so we're going to have to start expanding area codes and things like that. And it's really funny to see that, because inside of a multi-tenant environment, you could have a customer that could consume 2,000 VLANs easily.
Sure. Yeah, no, I could totally buy that. I also see there's performance advantages. There's some intrinsic security characteristics to that. Like, this is a good thing to happen to us, but clearly IPv4 is holding us back now.
Yeah, we're starting to see that. The solutions that we're having to come up with to make it all work together, things like carrier grade NAT, they just kind of make me shudder when I wake up in a cold sweat at night.
Yet another bandage.
Yes, yet another bandage. And unfortunately, it's a bandage that looks good enough on paper.
Yeah.
And in reality, when we deploy it, we realize that there are some pieces that are going to start breaking. There's an RFC out there. I'd have to dig it up. We can put it in the show notes, that did an impact analysis of carrier grade NAT, which is a one step higher NATing of home connections, and things that you would expect to not break did, like Xbox Live.
Ouch.
Or VoIP applications like Skype. And that really messes with the consumer when you flick on your Xbox to play Call of Duty and all of a sudden it doesn't work.
Well, this sounds like old school NAT problems, right? When we first had NAT, a lot of these kinds of apps barfed because they couldn't deal with the aliasing.
Oh, exactly. And we're just abstracting that to a higher level. And then, you know, look at things that are technically infeasible with that. Google Maps is a good example. When you open up Google Maps, it makes a bunch of AJAX calls to fill in those little map tiles. And if you're behind a carrier grade NATed system, when the number of NATs runs out, those tiles just don't load.
Wow. So obviously IPv6 is going to solve all these problems.
Well, we hope it does. Now, the problem we have right now with IPv6 is awareness and adoption.
Right.
The really technical people are adopting IPv6 and they're trying to drive the implementation of it as far as they can. But obviously, you're going to run into some technical issues as well. Home devices are a big problem. Most of the routers that you go out to Best Buy and get from the shelf for $50 or $60 don't really support anything other than IPv4. They just don't have enough memory. The processors aren't powerful enough. And it's kind of hard to talk people into going out and tossing out that just good enough device to spend $100 or $200 on a router simply because, oh, hey, we get more internet addresses.
Yeah, I mean, is the consumer really the issue? Couldn't the ISP fix this at the gateway point?
They could. They could do a 6-to-4 gateway where they could leave their customers on V4 and take a V6 gateway there and translate off of that. Problem one is you're getting into some very hairy translation mechanisms there.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem is that if there's one group of customers one group of people in the world that is more intolerant of upgrading their equipment than consumers, it's service providers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's the problem of being in the low-cost business. But it seems to me they hold all the keys here to making IPv6 essential.
Yeah, they do. And they're slowly coming along. I've been having some conversations with some people like Ed Horley, for instance,
mm-hmm.
who's a Microsoft MVP. And we started crunching some numbers to figure out exactly who was announcing all of this V6 address space out there, because there's more V6 address space being announced than just people who are running it in test mode. And from what we can tell, there's a significant number of the Fortune 500 that has turned it on to make sure that it works. Mm-hmm. And they just haven't told anybody that they're running it yet.
I mean, you got to wonder, at what point does a major service provider to the AT&Ts of the world just recognize that IPv6 is a marketing win? You want to win some new customers. You know, this becomes the new age thing. Are you on the real net?
Yeah. Yeah. And in the way I've thought about it, because I've put some thought into this, I think it's actually going to be when the customers force them to go that route.
Right.
But the only way to force customers to make their ISPs transition is to give them something that's only available over IPv6.
Right.
So, for instance, if Netflix comes out maybe in the next 18 months and announces that they're going to have support for 4K movies streamed to your TV, but you're only going to be able to do it over V6,
right,
then the customer base is going to run screaming to their provider saying, I got to have this right now because I got to be able to watch The Little Mermaid in 4K. But, you know, for the content companies like the Disneys and the Time Warners of the world, they should love this idea.
Right.
You know, user state tracking per device, because every device is going to have a globally reachable V6 address.
Right.
I can tell you exactly how many machines are playing any given movie at any given time. And I can pull those metrics to tell you, okay, well, that one's not authorized, and this one has three copies of the movie, and, you know, it's amazing the kinds of things you can go to, but, you know, you've got to have that pressure on the service providers to make that happen first.
But I also think in the enterprise side of things, getting IPv6 running inside of your organization is also a good pressing point. That's like, okay, well, we're using this everywhere internally anyway. When do we get to go over our WAN links with it?
Exactly. And so a lot of what you're seeing now is the drive to maybe get sites interconnected over V6 to do, you know, site V6 tunnels. And then once you get all that turned up, then maybe start announcing your presence to the internet.
Yeah, I feel like the public facing part of this is not only the hardest, but probably not the most important. You know, the scenario you painted at the beginning of this conversation around software-defined networking, clearly our lives get better if we're combining IPv6 and SDN together.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I've seen a lot of proposals for running V6-only data centers, and they really make sense.
Yeah, that's hard to imagine, because every story I've seen is all about V4, V6 coexistence. But to go dedicated V6...
A lot of it does exist for content perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, turning off your V4 is probably a really bad idea right now, and it's going to continue to live forever. I mean, how long did it take for us to finally get rid of DOS?
Have we? I don't know that we have.
I don't know. I was actually writing a batch file the other day for a customer.
No,
felt a little dirty. But you know. There's nothing wrong with keeping V4 around. It's making sure that V4 continuing to coexist does not co-opt the transition of services to V6.
Right.
In the original internet, the ways that they combated that, Vint Cerf is notoriously famous for going in one day when NCP, Network Control Protocol, was the primary internet data exchange protocol.
Yep.
He just shut it off for an hour when IPv4 rates had kind of plateaued for adoption.
Right.
And when he turned it back on an hour later, then suddenly the rates went up again. And then when they plateaued, he turned it off for 4 hours. And then eventually one day he sent an email to the people who were connected to the internet and said, all right, I'm turning NCP off today at 5 p.m. If you're not on IP, you're not getting on the internet
anymore. It's over. Yeah. Yeah. That's a heck of a lot smaller internet than it is today. That's for sure. But
You can't turn off V4 at the core. I mean, you would cripple the global internet.
Yeah.
And we definitely don't want to do that. But what you can do is you can start making new services only available over V6.
Yeah.
And that will drive adoption more than anything else.
Well, and I wonder if we won't just start throttling V4, or rather, you know, lighting up new fiber V6 only.
Yeah. That's an option. I've even seen people that have said, why don't we attach a significant cost to running V4 prefixes through BGP?
Yeah.
We can't turn it off, but we can make it so expensive to operate that you're not going to want to do it anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be that much more, right? Where right now it's about getting over the threshold of the learning you need to have to understand V6. And that's not that big. You know, the problem is V4, because of its convolutions, because of the changes in network massing and so forth, became very complicated to understand. And so we just presume that V6 is going to be worse. And I think it's better.
Yeah. It's, It looks scary at first. I mean, I can remember the first time I looked at an IPv6 address and I said, why are there colons in this? Oh my God. But, you know, as you go on and things start making sense, and it's actually kind of funny when you look at the number of things that were first kind of developed in IPv6 that got backported to V4 because they make sense.
Yep.
Like IPsec VPNs.
Yeah.
then you look at it and go, okay, maybe this kind of makes sense after all.
Yeah, well, I just like this idea that all of the things that we scabbed onto V4 are default in V6. Imagine multicast that actually worked.
Yeah, and no broadcast.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't need it anymore.
It's obsolete. It's an obsolete concept.
Yeah. Automatic addressing that works much better than DHCP and is completely stateless, so we don't have to mess with it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and yeah, and I guess the other problem is most of us that have gotten into networking in the recent years have always lived in this bizarro world of NAT, and we don't remember the nicer internet of the 90s when we didn't do any of that.
Yeah, I mean, I was having a discussion with John Kern from Aaron one day, and we were talking about NAT and V4 and things. He's like, listen, when we originally came up with the idea for IPv6, there was no World Wide Web.
Yeah.
It was mostly telnet and FTP traffic. And when people started NATing FTP traffic, we had to rewrite the protocol.
Yep.
Most of the things that we take for granted in modern networking are artifacts that came about after the adoption or the formal adoption process of V6 started. So, you know, the idea of having an automatically addressed host is kind of, you know, common to us now, but in 1993, that didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just didn't think that way.
Yeah.
So, we're back to the same old thing of it's worth getting V6 up and running inside of your own network. I mean, if folks are running modern Windows machines, by default, V6 is on all of them anyway.
Yeah, that was actually a mandate from the federal government about 2008 that any devices connecting to them had to be V6 capable and turned on by default.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you've been running V6. If you have anything newer than Vista installed, you just don't know it.
Right.
In fact, certain Microsoft services now, I can think of a couple in Exchange, require V6 local link local addressing. And
yep.
If you turn off V6 on the network card, Exchange really hates that.
Yeah, it gets really pouty.
Yes,
well, and direct access, too, depends on V6.
Yeah. And so, we've created an underlay network between our hosts on an addressing structure we're not quite capable of understanding if you're not an IPv6 networking person.
Sure.
But things just work when we turn it on, so might as well not turn it off.
Yeah, I guess the problem is that I think everyone has an issue with running two networking protocols simultaneously. Like, you know, I don't really know if these two machines are talking V4 or V6 to each other.
Yeah, you're right. And it is a problem. I would counter that by saying if you've been in networking more than 6 or 7 years, you've probably been running two protocols on top of each other already.
Sure.
I mean, IPX, SPX from Novell.
Yeah.
NetBIOS.
NetBUI.
Yeah.
Wins.
Make
it stop.
You're
just making me shudder.
Yeah, you know, so the concept isn't new. It's just that they're both different accents of the same language, basically.
Yeah, it's just not that big of a deal. And it's interesting that you can start putting rules in place, especially when we start looking at SDN. Like, to me, SDN allows us to create little pools of IPv6 operability. Why, if you've got a set of VMs that work together to build an application, why wouldn't you configure them to be IPv6 specific?
Yeah, I mean, it, from a security perspective, too.
I mean,
let's say if I'm only running V6 connectivity between these two devices and I have an edge firewalling device that doesn't permit V6 connectivity into my data center block,
yep.
I can guarantee you that those VMs are not going to be able to be reachable from the outside world.
Yeah, yeah. No kidding. Like, it's a very powerful, whole other level of DMZ thinking. That
yeah.
There's
and
a point where you enable IPv4 at the edge of that application, and that's it.
Yeah, and you, when you take on the automation and the provisioning aspects of SDN, and you kind of loop those two things together, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for people to kind of build some cottage industries around IPv6 translation and transition mechanisms and, you know, making sure that everything just kind of works. And then later, you know, the janitor approach of going back and tidying up all the old V4 that you don't need anymore.
Yeah, I can imagine at some point we're going to want tools that are just analyzing these packages and saying, you're just not, IPv4 shouldn't be on. You're not using it anyway.
We haven't seen a hit on our IPv4 address interface in 2 months.
Yeah.
We probably can go ahead and retire
that. Sort of shut that down. Yeah, that's an interesting piece of instrumentation. It'd be a great place to get to. Something to add to that list of monitoring I want is how much of this traffic's 4 and how much of it is 6.
Yeah.
When can I finally turn 4 off and eliminate a really significant vector in vulnerabilities?
Yeah.
It's just an interesting thought that the security angle on this, SDN pulling it together to be able to manage it as a compact group. I don't believe in the big switchovers anymore. Like, I just don't do that. It's got to be gradual. So being able to pick an individual project, a specific apps deployment, and saying, let's make that V6. That's
yeah, exactly, because we don't have the capability of doing that anymore. If it was a car, we can't pull over and change the tire. We have to change the tire while the car is going.
Yeah,
which can be done. I mean, yeah. I've seen videos of that on YouTube, but but it's not something you want to try without a really solid plan.
Yep, you better know.
Yeah,
but that's an interesting combination of things. Where do you see? I mean, I guess this is purely in the VMware and the Hyper-V space that SDN starting to make a lot of sense. Is there other areas people should be watching?
The virtualization is going to drive it because that's the biggest consumer of it right now inside the data center. Storage is going to get pretty close as well.
Yeah.
We're starting to see a lot more security as well, virtualized firewalls and even load balancers on the host. That's one of the things that VMware is driving towards, not just from their own software stack, but from other stacks as well. We're starting to see a lot of people that are saying, why can't we put security all the way down to the host level?
Yeah. Well, it makes you wonder if the dedicated network device is almost doomed at this point because of SDN.
Well, they're starting to see a big transition, so the technology running sidebar to SDN, kind of on the same tracks in parallel, is network function virtualization, which is the bottom-up approach to software enabling everything in the data center, which says, all right, so we've had this firewall forever. Why don't we go ahead and instead of running it on a physical CPU with physical RAM and physical processing,
right?
Let's just make that run in a VM. I mean, we can do that. That's
sure.
Pretty easy. Companies like Viata have been doing it for years now. So we make all that run inside of the virtual space, and then we can port that around as needed.
Mm-hmm. But you also see the dedicated hardware that's particularly good at the elements of IP and so forth would be faster, more efficient at this than the generic gear.
Yeah. We've been doing that for years. We've been trying to build devices that have custom ASICs to run things at lightning speeds. But what we're seeing now is that when you drop an octa-core Haswell processor on top of it, you can get almost the same amount of speed out of it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it seems like there's a real pressure here of how far general computing has come for the dollar per cycle cost to the advantage you get from ASICs.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, ASICs used to be all about, doing the most you can with very limited amounts of things like CAM and RAM and things in a router.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, we've got a glut of that. I mean, VMware has the ability to fire up a VM that has a terabyte of RAM in it. I don't think I've ever seen that much RAM.
It would take up a lot of room.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and the stuff's just gotten so insanely cheap for what you need.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I can remember when $2,500 to purchase a computer was what I considered a reasonable amount back
right.
in the day. $2,500 today would buy you a beast of a computer.
Oh, sure, monster. But it makes me wonder if I shouldn't get a chassis with a lot of PCIe slots in it, just start slamming a bunch of quad gigabits network cards into it and building my own super smart switch.
Believe it or not, that's actually the genesis behind a lot of the projects that are coming out. Facebook is trying to do something with x86 servers and just writing their own software to run on top of it. Cumulus Networks is doing an open source switch firmware that you can basically run your own device off of.
Wow. So
I mean,
well, I've always watched the Open Compute Project with big eyes.
Yeah, I mean, they understand what they need, and they can purpose build devices to that point. Intel's DPDK, their development kit for networking on servers, they can do crazy things. They can do 40 gig line rate forwarding through a motherboard.
Yeah, that's the other thing that is this sort of opens up is Now, some of these faster protocols that have always been too complex for most people to deal with are completely abstracted from you anyway.
Exactly. I remember going back and doing a networking course when I was first starting out, and the binary choices for routing protocols were RIP and OSPF.
Right.
And the rule of thumb was use RIP when it has to be fast, use OSPF when you have the extra processor power. And now we look at it going, OSPF used to be expensive to run processor-wise. You know, we're looking now at you know, tuning timers on OSPF where it can have sub-second failover, and that would have been unheard of back in the day.
Yeah, and I'm thinking a couple of the other weirder networking protocols that we've used over the years that are really, really fast and just were, you know, always specialty applications. Like, okay, I'm just going to connect these two machines this way, nothing else. I would never build because you don't want to buy a switch with it. I really appreciate the abstract, with these levels of abstraction now, we could actually introduce stuff like InfiniBand between machines, and you just don't have to know anything about it to use it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, things that used to be very processor intensive and expensive that took way too much overhead, we can start looking at those again. And that gives us a lot of flexibility. I mean, go look at some of the projects that they're doing inside of the ITF, like Trill, where we're going to try to replace all of our layer 2 constructs with what is essentially ISIS routing protocol running at layer 2.
Right. And you know, you've nailed it. We create this level of abstraction, and not only do we have the benefit of this automated configuration and so forth around SDN, but now we get to switch out the underlay without telling anybody.
Yeah.
It just happens. Because I remember looking at InfiniBand switching, and these things were tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And now they really don't need to be, and you can put them where you need to and pretty much make the whole behavior transparent.
Yeah, I mean, when you can switch out large portions of your underlay without affecting your customer base on top, it gives you a lot more flexibility to drive performance out of it. So, oh, hey, by the way, guys, we went ahead and changed out all the 10 gig uplinks to 40 gig uplinks, so you should see a couple of extra milliseconds of latency shaved off of your stuff, and we'll just throw that in for free. And what we really did it for was that way we could bring on our next huge database customer who can now do Hadoop clustering across, you know, geographic disparate data centers because we have the uplink capability to do it.
Yeah, that's astonishing. Well, sir, where can we run across you? What are you working on next?
Well, right now I'm trying to get my head wrapped around some more of the application networking SDN type stuff. That's what I spend most of my time doing when I'm not, you know, facilitating interactions between vendors and bloggers and things like that. But a lot of my writing goes up on my blog at networkingnerd.net. I also do some blogging at Network Computing every once in a while. And then if you want more real-time feedback, you can always tune into my Twitter stream. It's Networking Nerd. And occasionally I'm a little snarky.
Nothing wrong with that. It just means you're paying attention.
Exactly.
Tom, thanks so much for talking to me.
Richard, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I hope all your listeners got a good feeling for what we talked about today.
It's exciting stuff. I'm really, really stoked about it. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.